Amid the governor's reopening of Texas, new COVID-19 patients filling hospital beds in Texas's largest city. A second wave? That story and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. A spike in COVID-19 cases raising red flags. We'll have details. Remember the military troops ordered into places like Washington, D.C. during protests? As those troops return, many others face possible discipline for refusing to deploy in the first place. More trouble for the energy capital of the world. This time it's not oil prices they're worried about. And how a hashtag about life in higher ed in Texas led to a national conversation. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Monday, the 15th of June, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Within the hour, as we went to air statewide, a major decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, one of several we've been closely watching. In a case involving the Title VII law that prohibits sex discrimination in the workplace, the nation's highest court decided that the term sex, for the purposes of the law, is non-binary, meaning that workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity is also prohibited. The decision was 6-3, with Justice Neil Gorsuch writing for the majority, joined by Chief Justice John Roberts. Remember the name Bostock, the plaintiff's name in one of the two cases jointly decided here, because the decision is certain to be considered a landmark. The New York Times called it a stunning victory for LGBT equality. The news appears to have broken the internet, as I'm sure we'll hear many comments when our social media editor Wells Dunbar joins us in a few minutes. But first, healthcare workers in Texas sounding an alarm over a dramatic spike in COVID-19 cases in the Lone Star State. Among those cities reporting a rapid rise in COVID-19 hospitalizations, the biggest and most diverse city in Texas, Houston. A team at the Houston Chronicle, including its data editor and medical reporter, has been covering the pressure on area hospitals. Jenny Deem is part of the team. She's an investigative reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Jenny, welcome back to the Texas Standard. Good to have you on the broadcast.
Thank you. Good morning.
From your reporting in Houston, what are hospitals experiencing there when it comes to rising numbers of COVID-19 cases?
Well, there is definitely a rise happening. There is an increase, and it's fairly startling because it has come upon hospitals so quickly. There in the last week, four out of five days, they broke records for COVID cases. And that is just since the end of May.
Now, medical experts you spoke with say they expected a rise in cases and hospitalizations as Governor Abbott moved to reopen the state's economy early last month. Just how prepared are these hospitals for these new cases? Are any of them approaching capacity?
Well, it depends on how you kind of slice that pie. The hospitals the larger hospitals seem to be okay at this point. One of the complicating factors is that along with reopening businesses, hospitals also began restarting elective surgeries. So some of the beds that may have gone, particularly in ICU, that may have gone to COVID patients in the past, also have to be shared with those patients that are recovering from surgery. So that is, I think, one of the things that's making hospital administrators nervous. I think they're not at capacity, but they're very concerned that it's creeping up. Now, the smaller hospitals, like the one that I visited, they're pretty much bursting at the seams with COVID patients.
Governor Abbott has indicated he doesn't have plans to slow the state's reopening efforts. Is that your understanding?
My understanding is that he is aware but not concerned.
Aware but not concerned. What's the course of action here? Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo introduced a new COVID-19 threat level system last week, putting the county on a second to highest risk level. What does that mean there?
Well, I think that given the fact that there are that there are there's the reopening, that people are relaxing their vigilance, and that that there is a concern sort of citywide among both political leaders, like the county judge, like the mayor, and hospital and healthcare workers, that this could be, we could be moving into a very difficult situation.
But as I understand it, the highest threat level, that next level, means that people would be advised to stay at home, as many Texans were doing before May. But as I understand it, too, that's not enforceable, even if it were declared, because of the governor's orders, or what?
Well, I think because of the governor's orders, but I also think that there's a, you know, that there's a psychological factor here. I think that people were vigilant by and large in Houston. I think that they did take a lot of precautions, a lot of mask wearing, but I think that there was also, there is a sense that they're done with that. And it's very difficult, I think, for the general public to understand what's going on. There are so many mixed messages that it's okay. No, it's not okay. You know, hospitals are concerned, but they're not full. So I think that it's difficult for most people who really don't want to stay at home to understand what the true threat assessment is.
Jenny Deem is an investigative reporter for the Houston Chronicle, focusing on healthcare. Jenny, thanks again.
Thank you.
Active duty and National Guard troops have been redeployed out of cities like Washington, D.C. after tense protests. But some service members are facing consequences because they didn't deploy in the first place. For the American Homefront Project, Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports.
In California, more than 2,400 National Guard members rushed to major cities as protests erupted following the death of George Floyd. But one member of the California Air National Guard refused the order to go.
You know, if I'm made the decision to go along with it, I feel like I would sort of be compromising, you know, who I am in that moment.
He says his senior command has warned him about possible disciplinary actions, but he doesn't yet know what they'll be. The guardsman asked to remain anonymous to prevent a worse outcome, and his voice has been altered. Though he anticipated some consequences, he says he wasn't comfortable carrying a weapon around people exercising their First Amendment rights. And as a person of color who sympathizes with the Black Lives Matter movement, he says the guard's presence stifled protests.
What we're told is discourage people from, you know, criminal activity and things like that, but that doesn't necessarily what is going to be communicated on the ground when you see people, you know, in uniform with weapons, you know, standing around a formation. So
he joined the guard expecting to do humanitarian work and was surprised by the call to police his own state. And he says he's not alone.
We have people dealing with COVID. We've had people dealing with, you know, natural disasters and things like that. But to actually go out and be sort of this invading force, like, many people are not comfortable with it. They feel like it's not really what they signed up for.
When the protests began, more than 20 states called up their National Guardsmen, and President Trump ordered guardsmen to patrol the streets of Washington. The president also threatened to send active duty service members into cities across the country. Since then, veteran service organizations and GI rights groups say troops have been calling to learn about their options for refusing orders. Bill Galvin is a counselor for the GI Rights Hotline.
We've seen a real uptick in people in the National Guard, mostly, but some in the reserves, who are facing call-up, and who are saying, I don't know that this is something I can do. Some of them have said, I'm sympathetic to the protests, and others have said, I don't think I should be at war with people in my own country.
Galvin says troops expressed all kinds of concerns: risk of moral injury, lack of riot control training, and the possibility of acting against the Constitution. Galvin says at the peak of the protests, he took several calls a day. Whatever the reason, refusing to deploy can have consequences.
We do know there's a lot of folks who have chosen not to show, And of course, there's a range of possibilities, everything from a military court-martial and some jail time to more administrative kind of punishments that might even include being kicked out with a bad discharge. It's also quite possible the command could just ignore it. You know, they could say, well, we got enough people otherwise, so we're just going to forget about this. I mean, you just don't know at this point.
The Veterans Peace Advocacy Group About Face say they know of some 10 service members who have taken concrete steps to avoid deployment. Many more have asked for support. One is an active duty Army soldier stationed in the Midwest. Though his unit was never deployed, he says he wouldn't have gone if they had. The soldier asked for anonymity because he expects reprisal from his command and the public. His voice has been changed. He says some of the riot control tactics used in D.C. reminded him of things he saw in Iraq, and he says they shouldn't be used against Americans.
To me, it's like that violence that we do overseas is coming back home to roost.
National Guard officials at the Pentagon say they're not aware of any widespread disciplinary issues related to the protest response. They added that guardsmen deployed to D.C. executed their mission with compassion and professionalism. This is Carson Frame reporting.
That story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration on American military life and veterans with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Big news day, and our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is monitoring what listeners are talking about. Hit us with it, Wells.
Hi, David. Well, we're hearing from folks about that landmark ruling from the Supreme Court protecting LGBT people from discrimination in the workplace. Via Twitter, Natasha Harper Madison has two thoughts. One, what took so long? And two, happy Pride, referring here to June Pride Month. Over on Facebook, Carlo Mejia writes, Neil Gorsuch coming in clutch. Who'd have thought? Referring there to the conservative jurist that wrote the majority opinion. And Jamie Gump says, looks like it was a stupid time for the Trump administration to roll back protections last weekend, referring there to a Friday announcement from the White House that it was rolling back Obama-era health protections for transgender people. And with today's ruling, speaking to Title VII of 1964 Civil Rights Act, lots of comment online that the Trump administration change has been nullified as well, those anti-discrimination protections in health care. Just one of the stories we're keeping an eye on, David. We're going to continue to see reaction on this and other stories, so I'll be back with more of that later in the program.
Later, he means 35 minutes or so from now. We'd love to hear your comments, Texas. You know what to do. You look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice, and you tweet us with your comments about what's making news across the Lone Star State on this Monday. We would love to hear from you. There's a whole lot more of the Texas Standard just ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. After six major flooding disasters in 5 years, Houston has crafted its first ever climate action plan. It comes as cities around the world try to meet goals to be carbon neutral by 2050 in line with the Paris Climate Agreement. Houston Public Media's Jen Rice and Katie Watkins teamed up to see just how far Houston's plan goes in addressing climate change in the energy capital of the world.
We talked to city officials, environmental advocates, and business leaders about Houston's 100-page climate plan, and nearly everybody said it was a great first step.
In fact, a lot of people think the fact that Houston has a climate action plan is impressive. After all, the city is the oil and gas capital of the world.
Most people we talked to said there are two things Houston can do pretty easily: power city buildings with renewable energy and switch their fleet to electric vehicles. But the city's chief sustainability officer, Laura Cottingham, told me they were already working on them.
But I could also point to any number of existing city programs that are already out there in the works prior to the climate action plan.
Other things they're working on: designing more efficient buildings and reducing how much waste goes to the landfill.
Environmental leaders say Houston's setting an example for others in the region. Here's John Hall with the Environmental Defense Fund.
We are very pleased with the bold leadership that Mayor Turner has taken.
The city may be leading by example, but the plan doesn't really enforce anything. Gavin Dillingham is with the Hark research firm, which is giving technical advice for the plan.
There was not much focus on regulations or any really kind of mandate type activity. That wasn't something that was necessarily seen as being doable, at least at this time, with the stakeholders that were involved.
He says the goal was to get as many people on board as possible, and they did get buy-in from the business community. Bob Harvey, CEO of the Greater Houston Partnership, says the focus on goals rather than mandates is one of the best parts of the plan.
I'm really hoping that Houston continues to rely on more of a model of, hey, let's get the public and the business community to buy in and then unleash them, rather than thinking the city is somehow going to identify all the right levers and mandate those.
But others doubt how effective the plan can be without any mandates. Brittany Flowers with Texas Campaign for the Environment says it weakens the entire effort.
If there's no direct enforcement component, then how are 50% or 60% of these metrics, which are identified to be led by the community or by industry, going to be enforced and monitored?
That lack of enforcement is why Jordan Maka with Bayou City Waterkeeper is concerned about what happens when the next mayor takes office.
If this isn't put into firm action, the next mayor can just scrap this whole idea and say, like, well, I'm done with this.
Another thing notably absent from the plan, some of the region's biggest polluters. Stephanie Thomas from Public Citizen says a lot of the refineries aren't inside the city limits.
The city can do a lot, but we need actual support from the entire region to make this a reality.
Still, Thomas and others told us it's a starting point, and its success depends on how it's implemented.
And how much local institutions buy in and change the city's culture.
I'm Katie Watkins.
And I'm Jen Rice.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. It was just May of last year, President Trump visited Louisiana's Sempra Energy liquefied natural gas plant, declaring the U.S. the energy superpower of the world. Texas, too, had recently made big investments in LNG exporting facilities along the Gulf Coast, like the new one in Freeport. But the celebrations over opening up vast new markets have largely subsided, at least for now, as shipments for LNG have fallen by 60% since peaks earlier this year. Energy insider Matt Smith has an eye on the market. He is director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back to the Standard.
Thank you, David.
The obvious question is, why are U.S. LNG exports dropping?
Well, basically, David, the world is awash with natural gas at a time that the market has been walloped by this huge demand shock via the coronavirus. This has essentially pushed prices down across the globe, putting them on par or even below U.S. Gulf Coast prices, when typically you see Asia and Europe paying more for their natural gas. As you mentioned there, so far in June, we're seeing exports down about 50-60% versus what we saw earlier in the year. And you've got these companies essentially that have these agreements, they're called take or pay agreements, where you either take the gas or you have to pay for it anyway. And what you're seeing are these companies are paying for the gas, but they're just not taking receipt of it. And just highlights how much of a oversupply there is in the global market here.
Are we seeing the same for any other energy exports out of the U.S. Gulf, like oil or other refined products? And if so, why?
Yeah, sure, we are. So just as we see domestic demand in the U.S. still lagging from normal levels, that's actually not too bad when compared to everywhere else where they're getting pummeled. So essentially, the largest market for refined products is Latin America, and you know they're in the midst of the coronavirus there, and so we're seeing gasoline exports down by about half versus year ago levels, even worse for the middle distillate side of things. And then with oil too, oil exports are down by about a third versus May. So we're seeing that demand weakness showing up across the board.
I suppose this is a bit of a sidebar here, but Tropical Storm Cristobal came through the Gulf last week. Any impact that you could detect?
Yeah, so the storm made landfall last Monday, and we saw Gulf of Mexico oil production taken offline. We saw about 630,000 barrels offline on Monday. That was the peak, and about 1 BCF a day of natural gas. So to put that in context, that's about 6% of US oil production and 1% of natural gas production. But that's gradually coming back online now. But the bigger takeaway here, David, is that this is somewhat setting the stage of what is to come, because NOAA, which is part of the National Weather Service, is predicting an above normal hurricane season. And so we're only 15 days into official hurricane season, and we've already had three named storms, two of which have already made landfall.
Of course, no one wants to see any destruction or problems linked to those sorts of storms. On the other hand, if you're slowing production, it might have an impact itself on the oversupply, at least in the marketplace, no?
Yes, but it's only a very temporary thing when you have these hurricanes coming through. So it's just going to make a blip as opposed to any kind of new trend.
Yeah, I see. So, sorry for interrupting. How long can we expect this trend of lower prices in the LNG markets to last? I suppose it's as long as coronavirus continues to eat away at demand.
Well, yeah, the energy market is this boom and bust cycle. And so back a few years ago, there was a lot of investment in LNG, as we've seen on the U.S. Gulf Coast. And because of that investment, there's a lot of supply coming to the market at a time when it just isn't needed. And so we're going to need that demand side of the picture to catch up with the supply side, or we're going to have to see supply dialed back to balance this market again.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, thanks again.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Today is the last day to register to vote in the Texas primary runoff election, which is set for July 14th. Keith Ingram is director of the Elections Division at the Texas Secretary of State's office. He explains the early voting period has been extended as a result of the coronavirus pandemic.
So it begins the 29th of June and runs through July the 10th. That will exclude July the 3rd and 4th, as those are holidays, but every other day in there, if you're in a big county, you should have voting opportunities.
Voter registration applications can be downloaded from the website votetexas.gov. People then need to print and mail it to the voter registrar's office in their county of residence. A new analysis of arrest records from the first weekend of protest in Texas against police brutality and systemic racism shows almost all of the demonstrators were from the state, despite the governor's warnings about outside agitators. Texas Public Radio's Bree Kirkham has more.
Data provided to the Texas Newsroom shows 167 protest-related arrest reports in Austin, Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio during the first weekend of mass demonstrations. All but two of those individuals, 165 people, have Texas addresses. While some Texans traveled to larger cities to participate in protest, only 8% live more than 50 miles away from the city where they were arrested. And the records show just 27% live more than 25 miles away. Ages were included in most reports from that weekend as well. 36 of the people apprehended were teenagers, and 74 were in their 20s. Of note, more than half of the charges involving violence were among people in their 30s and 40s. I'm Bree Kirkham in San Antonio.
Sales activity for single-family homes in Texas continues to nosedive as the impact of the COVID-19 outbreak discourages buyers and sellers. Professor Luis Torres co-authored April's housing report published last Thursday for Texas A&M University's Real Estate Center.
Texas was almost a 14% decline with respect to March. Now, in May, we're expecting that decrease based on our information. You're still going to have a double-digit decrease, but it's going to be at a lower rate.
The Houston and Dallas metro areas saw even bigger declines in single-family home sales than the state as a whole. Meanwhile, the construction of new homes and building permits in April also plunged more than 20% compared to March. Torres says median home prices in Texas continued growing, but at a slower rate than the month before. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered, weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Nationwide protests over police violence have opened up conversations about racism in all sectors, including a place some call the Ivory Tower. The name comes from institutions of higher ed as a place where there's space for the pursuit of academic interests. In reality, the Ivory Tower is far from the utopia it might sound. When University of Texas at Austin PhD student Joy Melody Woods began sharing her experiences on social media using the hashtag #BlackInTheIvory, she shook that ivory tower hard and sparked a national conversation. Joy Melody is studying health equity and interpersonal communication at UT Austin. Joy Melody, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
This hashtag's been around now for about a week or so. Are you surprised at the level it's taken off?
Yes, very much so. That was not me and my colleague, Dr. Sade Davis's intentions.
Tell us a little bit more. You talk about you and your colleague. Was this something that you thought a lot about before you started using the hashtag, or was it something rather spontaneous?
Rather spontaneous. We were up late. I was tweeting and she was tweeting, and she said, hey, why don't we just use this hashtag about what we're tweeting about so we can streamline our thoughts? Before she could say anything else, I used the hashtag, and we went to sleep, we woke up, and it was viral.
Wow. So let's take apart that term ivory tower just a little bit more. What was behind your use of that specifically?
Like the introduction you said, that's what it's called, and people think it is a utopia. And then also that I always think of that song Ebony and Ivory, and so we're having this conversation of what it's like to be Black in a white space.
Is this about primarily sharing personal experiences, about seeking change, or both?
Definitely both. We hope that the sharing of these personal experiences allows institutions and departments across this country to realize that there needs to be change, and now we can have these more serious, in-depth conversations about what it actually looks like and what we hope it could look like in the future.
Would you share one of your stories with us here?
Yeah, when I was in my master's program, not at the University of Texas, I had a faculty member tell me that I was only there because I was Black. I was a diversity admit. Everything I turned in sounded like I didn't know how to speak English. They told me I wouldn't get into a PhD program. So many other things that aren't even pleasant to say on the radio. And it really began to weigh on me as I thought there was something wrong with me. And come find out, I filed a complaint, and there was a few other Black colleagues of mine had filed complaints before about different faculty in this department. And it just let me know that was 3 years ago, that there's a serious issue and I wasn't alone. And I ended up having to switch programs and I got my master's. But that's just a little tidbit of we always have to move around and try to find the support we need to be successful.
One criticism in all sectors about making real change is that the work often falls on the backs of people of color. Mm-hmm. Since you've helped start this conversation, what are your recommendations for the best path forward?
If there's so many, but I'll start with the falling on the backs of people of color. If you want us to be a part of the conversation, Black and brown folks, we've probably already done the work and had the conversations, and it was dismissed within institutions. Go back to those faculty and pay them for the extra labor and listen to them and implement that change. That's really what needs to be what happened. Pay the people you want to help you, and the labor will be great instead of doing all this unpaid labor to bring the change that we know will help us.
What else needs to change? I mean, I would think that maybe attitudes more fundamentally.
Yes, attitudes most definitely more fundamentally, looking at the structure and the foundation that the institution is founded on, institution of higher ed as a whole, and look at, you know, what are the processes and little nuances that actually are rooted in exclusion and aren't really inclusive to not only Black students, but other students of color.
Well, it's interesting that this hashtag, in some ways, isn't really just yours anymore. It's taken off, as you were mentioning, it's viral, and a lot of people have embraced it. How do you feel about that? And have you seen any usages that you feel maybe haven't been true to your original mission?
You know, I feel overwhelmed, joyous, no pun intended, and super excited. I have to be honest with you. We haven't, because it's taken off, we really haven't seen too many, or if at any, it being used in the wrong way. And I could have overlooked it because there's been so many tweets. But overall, it seems to be people sharing their true stories and then other faculty who aren't Black saying, hey, tune into this hashtag so you can see like what our Black colleagues are going through. So it's been overwhelmingly positive.
Joy Melody Woods is a PhD student at the University of Texas at Austin. She co-founded the hashtag Black in the Ivory. Joy Melody, thanks again for speaking with us on The Standard.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
My name is Christine Cantella. I am a resident of Fulton, Texas, but I am working currently in London, United Kingdom. I came to the UK in September of last year, and we were about to really get into production on this job, and then the virus started. I had the opportunity to head back to the States in the middle of March, and I really just felt like I didn't want to make that trip. I contacted my family in Texas. They were okay. I have more family in Pennsylvania who I contacted, and they were okay, and everyone was staying put. And I felt like I should do the same. I didn't want to make that journey. It's just such a strange time right now because nobody really knows 100% one way or the other what's safe to do. And so my job keeps reassuring me that they are going to start again, but I just don't know when. So I can't think about making that trip twice, say the job starts back up in a month, taking that chance to get on a plane with all the safety gear that you have to do and the wipe downs and everything, and worry about infecting my family once I see them after quarantine or whatever, and then getting back on a plane again to come back out here to start the job again. Being in London feels okay. It's a city I really love, and modern technology makes it easy to talk to family, even though it's not the same as being in the room. Being in London is fantastic because it is a city and I don't feel far away from all of the conveniences. But I'll tell you what, it's nothing like being in Fulton, being able to just walk a block or so to the sea and just look at the ocean, watch the pelicans come in. Right now, I would probably be spraying my yard for mosquitoes, putting up the hammocks, and trying to grow some kind of a garden. This is Christine Cantella, a South Texan living in London during the coronavirus crisis, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. More than ever, Americans are questioning the role of police in their communities. More than a week before George Floyd's death, a viral arrest video in Midland sparked outrage there after it showed multiple officers aiming their weapons at Ty Anders, a young Black man, as he's lying on the ground surrendering to police. As Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden reports, many residents see it as just another example of the police department's ongoing use of excessive force toward people of color.
Just 3 days after George Floyd's death, dozens of people flooded a community forum on policing put on by the city of Midland. As they filed in and out, attendees keep telling me similar things.
I have black kids. I don't want my kids to be profiled just because of their color.
It's racial profiling. Midland is prejudice.
Where does it stop? When does it stop?
That was Blake Black, LaVonda Johnson, and Freddie Joe Ray, who have all lived in Midland for decades. At the forum and in general, local leaders are standing by officers' actions during Tyander's arrest. Midland's district attorney even put out an official statement saying she doesn't see any problems with how Midland's police department handled the situation. But what city officials see as a tense yet by-the-book arrest looked very different to many of the Black Midlanders I interviewed. They saw fear. And the details around Anders' arrest reeked a bias to some. In Midland PD's arrest affidavit, an officer outlines how they followed Anders for a while before supposedly seeing the young man roll through a stop sign. Pastor LaVonda Johnson says if you're black here, being tailed by the police isn't uncommon.
This is what they do. They followed him. They pick on him.
Racial profiling.
Deep. In Midland, Texas. Each one of my sons have been racially profiled.
There is an insidious trend in this city that allows for police brutality against minorities, and we're not going to stand for it.
That's Justin Moore, the Dallas-based criminal and civil rights attorney who's representing Tyander's.
We would like for an outside agency to investigate the city of Midland and their police department. I mean, ever since taking this case, I've received an overwhelming amount of calls, and I've been getting tale and story after story about how Midland PD is terrorizing its citizens.
As the nation is reckoning with law enforcement's treatment of minorities, Midlanders are speaking out about their experiences. Lifelong resident Wanda McCowan can quickly tick off a list of what to avoid if you're not white and don't want to get pulled over.
You better not have a nice car. You better not. It better not be a certain color. You better not be driving with more four people in it. Or you're going to get stopped.
Yeah.
At the community forum after Tyander's arrest, Midland Police Chief Seth Herman told the crowd his officers don't discriminate.
Your concern for bias by us, by profiling people, that's real. My perception of it is we're working very hard to make sure that that is not a reality for us, that we are not employing bias.
Herman says his department does a number of things to weed out prejudice, including releasing an annual report called the Racial Profiling Analysis. Each year, the study looks at the number of traffic stops that ended with some sort of warning, ticket, or arrest. According to the reports from 2016 to 2019, though, Black and Hispanic drivers were consistently pulled over at higher rates than white drivers. Last year, Black individuals were almost twice as likely to be arrested after a traffic stop than their white counterparts. In 2019, Midland PD made 1,220 traffic stops that included a search. One in five of those drivers were African American. That's a stark comparison when you consider the demographics out here. Out of the approximately 177,000 people who lived in Midland County in 2019, only about 7% were African American, and around 45% were white. Texas State University's Dr. Brian Withrow has been studying police bias for two decades. He says trends like this don't just happen.
There's a reason why those numbers are higher, and that reason may not be something illegal or unconstitutional, but there's a reason why they're higher.
Beyond research, Winthrow was also a cop for 13 years. He says Midland's numbers are interesting, but they don't automatically mean local police are intentionally prejudiced. In general, Withrow says racial profiling is really hard to prove, and the data from traffic stops only paints part of the picture. But Winthrow says if the data consistently indicates minorities are pulled over at high rates, and more to the point, if locals are scared of the police, then Midland has a problem.
If I'm a black man, I'm looking at those numbers and I see year after year after year, it's black people being overrepresented in stops, arrests, and searches, then it'd be pretty hard for me to tell my son, that's okay, you can trust the police.
In a written statement, a spokesperson for the Midland Police Department told Marfa Public Radio no complaints were filed against officers last year concerning racial profiling, and noted none of the department's policies caused people of color to be pulled over more than white drivers. The Midland Police Department also says none of its policies explain the trends shown in its report, instead characterize it as a problem with the state's reporting requirements and how data is collected. That probably won't comfort residents like Wanda McCowan, who believes the next George Floyd could easily be from her community.
As mothers and sisters, we're afraid for our husbands, our brothers, our sons. And something got to change, and it's got to start in Midland also, because if we don't do something here in Midland, I'm afraid what happened in Minneapolis is going to happen here.
It's been a little over 2 weeks since the forum. Midland City Council has met one time since then, and the police department did not come up on the meeting's agenda. City officials have said they are going to have more community town halls on policing in the future, but none are currently scheduled. I'm Mitch Borden in Midland.
You're tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Haggling over the meaning of defund the police may well decide the future of what policing looks like. Protests over George Floyd's death have inserted the idea into the public consciousness, but its exact definition is open to interpretation. For some, defund the police means exactly that. For others, it's more nuanced, a call for reform and reallocation of funds rather than a complete dismantling. Here to talk more about that range of interpretations is William Kelly. He's a professor of sociology and director of the Center for Criminology and Criminal Justice Research at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a member of the City of Austin Public Safety Commission. Professor Kelly, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
The idea of defunding the police, as I was saying, there has different meanings to different people. How would you describe the spectrum of definitions that fall under that phrase?
I think you nailed it. I mean, I think there are some abolitionists who want to do away with law enforcement as we know it. At the other end of that, or somewhere in the middle of that, are folks who want to reallocate funding from law enforcement to social services. And then at the other extreme are those who don't want to touch it at all. I'm sort of a fan of balance. I think that both the extremes are inappropriate for a variety of reasons. There certainly are problems with local law enforcement. Is there racism? Yes. Is there a culture of fear within the police department? Yes. Are there problems with accountability? Absolutely. And believe me, I appreciate the impatience. I've been following racism in the criminal justice system and law enforcement for 40 years in my career. And I'm a liberal Democrat. I want to get that on the record as well. But I think we need to think a bigger picture here in terms of what is all this about. The reason that there are so many problems with law enforcement today are decisions made by policymakers to not fund things like public health and public mental health and addiction treatment.
Well, now let me stop you right there, because it seems like part of the argument here for defunding the police is that they've been given too many jobs, that they're not the best people to, say, work with people who are homeless or help someone with a mental health crisis. So in a more perfect world, how more narrowly should the role of police be tailored in society?
I think we need to think carefully about what we want law enforcement to do and to not do. You're absolutely right. They're not psychologists. They're not psychiatrists. They shouldn't be handling mental health issues. They shouldn't have to be handling the mess created by the lack of funding for a variety of different social services. What we really need them for either is law enforcement narrowly defined, or in my mind, at least in the near term, a much broader focus on community policing. It decentralizes law enforcement within a geographic area into smaller communities. It puts cops in establishing relationships with businesses, with property owners, with residents. It enhances the flow of information both ways. It's focused on problem solving and, importantly, sort of forging a path between law enforcement and the community, and helps to mitigate many of those negative feelings that persist today.
What do you think of the idea that police reforms have failed and that dismantling at this juncture is really the only option?
The policies have failed, but I hesitate to say this, but I think there is a tremendous amount of energy and focus at the moment. I've said this over the decades. Maybe this is finally the time when we're going to get serious about fundamentally reforming law enforcement. At the same time, unions and associations for law enforcement tend to get in the way of that. So, I mean, there are plenty of challenges here. But, I mean, I think you will find little debate among many that we need to change how we do this. It is not the way to enhance public safety effectively. But simply throwing out the baby with the bathwater, it actually makes me quite concerned when I hear people advocate for that, because they say dismantle it, but they don't tell us what to replace it with. I don't think is really a good idea. And it's not in the interest of public safety.
But for others in the community, particularly in the Black community, police are not seen as a symbol of safety, but as a source of potential harm. How do communities with different policing experiences find a solution that keeps everyone safer, given the dynamics you've just described?
I think one of the things we can start doing is what they do with federal judges, and that is test for implicit and explicit bias. And I totally understand the relationship between local law enforcement and minority communities. It's a horrific relationship. But community policing, in theory, and in practice, is designed to help mitigate those kinds of problems. It is not the silver bullet, but it's a big step in the right direction, but it requires resources. Defunding law enforcement, as well-intentioned as that might be to transfer funds to other social services, also defunds community policing efforts.
William Kelly is a professor of sociology and director of the Center for Criminology and Criminal Justice Research at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a member of the City of Austin Public Safety Commission. Professor Kelly, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. With that social media signal, we should address something listeners picked up on earlier in the broadcast when we mentioned healthcare experts are concerned about a much warned off second wave of COVID-19.
Yes, sir.
Well, now, as many listeners have correctly noted, we're not out of the first wave yet. The number of cases continues to spike. However, hospitalizations had been declining and last week spiked up to historic levels. But just to be clear, Wells, and as NPR has noted, we're not out of the first wave yet when it comes to confirmed cases of the virus. Well, that's the voice of Wells Dunbar, social media editor. I know you've been fielding a lot of comments on that.
Yeah, definitely. Continuing to hear from folks about this, and not surprisingly, because obviously the pandemic has upended pretty much everything about our lives. One respective comment from what we've been seeing here via Twitter from Francesco Conti. He says, reporting the current surge of COVID-19 as a second wave distracts from the fact that it was self-inflicted by our governor's policies. He goes on to say the virus will have a resurgence on its own terms this fall or winter due to seasonal viral infections if we continue to stick our head in the sand. So obviously, folks continuing to watch that, you know, the spike in COVID cases we've seen, I guess, as the New York Times characterized over the weekend, all across the Sun Belt, Texas, Arizona, Florida. Mm-hmm. So obviously concerning trends upward. I know in Austin, they've surpassed this metric of rolling 7-day hospitalizations, going over 20 hospitalizations a day. Wow. It's sort of the metric for kicking into the next level of local restrictions there. So
in the meantime, we should point out that the reopening of Texas under Governor Abbott's plan continues without any sign of that, of a rollback.
Continues unabated, correct. Well, another big story breaking over the weekend, pretty interesting one here, demands from student athletes at the University of Texas at Austin that the school change long-standing names and traditions with ties to a racist past. Yeah, in an open letter, athletes asked UT officials to rename some campus buildings named after Texans with racist views, remove a statue of James Hogg, then a prominent segregationist, and also contribute to advocacy organizations like Black Lives Matter and more. The athletes also ask that UT discontinue its school fight song, The Eyes of Texas, which they note has ties to minstrel shows and the turn of the century. So interesting turn of events here.
Yeah.
Facebook.
I was just going to say those athletes say that they're not going to participate in any sort of fundraising activities and that sort of thing if the school doesn't change its policy.
Yes, the plan is to continue to practice, suit up, but not attend some fundraising events and ancillary events, I guess you could say. Gary Glass says schools revolve around athletics. When athletes can unionize into one voice, there will be no holding them back. In effect, money talks. Gary Glass there, a listener on Facebook.
We'd love to hear your comments, Texas. You know what to do. Just reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, or your social media platform of choice. We're out of time for the broadcast. The news continues over at texasstandard.org. On behalf of Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, and the rest of the Texas Standard team, I'm David Brown, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.